Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Our program for another week. Yeah, take it from us as we hit the back end of the year. We're into July. Hope you've been looking after yourself, staying warm and checking in on each other and making sure we're all going along as best as we can. Leave us a note, of course. Get to our Facebook page, facebook.com. Take it from us. I wanted to tell you about a very special day I had on Sunday. I took my son and a few mates as well to the Warriors game at Mount Smart. Now, I've been going to the Warriors game since I was a young fella, since 1995, and it's been more than 1,000 days since they last had a home game, obviously because of the COVID pandemic. We know that they've been based in Australia. And so when the opportunity to grab some tickets came up for this, we jumped on it. My son's only, he's just coming up four, so he's never been to the game. The drive to the ground was, it was a little surreal, because you're having to remind yourself, man, has it really been 3 years since we did this? Yes, it has. Pulling into the car park, walking into the ground. But there was a great buzz around the place. And it was basically a sellout. The place was jam-packed. And when the Warriors walked out to start, they'd been training out the back, which was great. So no one could see them. We hadn't had a chance to look at them warm up. They were right out of the back. And then when the game was about to start, that they came out to this amazing welcome, and when they walked out through the tunnel like they would have done all of those years ago, man, I had a lump in my throat. I think it was a very powerful moment. It was moving. And, you know, my mates said the same thing afterwards too, that, wow, goosebumps. It was a little bit emotional just to think that it had been so long since people had that opportunity to experience what kind of, for a lot of people in the crowd, was a sense of normality. You know, you've got a lot of season ticket holders who go to 10 or 12 games each year. It's just a regular part of life. Going along to the Warriors in winter is a part of life, and that has been denied for so many people now for so long. So it just, there was magic in the air. It was just one of those wonderful occasions where you were very thankful to be a part of. And yeah, it's a game of sport, but it was a reminder to me anyway, of what we've all had to endure, of what we've all been through, and the sacrifices that people have had to make. And the fact that we now get this back, okay, we get three or four games in Auckland this year, but hopefully a sense of normality will return for next season. There's been a lot happening in our lives, and just to get back to the footy, get back to it, was just wonderful. And to see so many people who had probably been yearning that opportunity to actually finally get it was magic. It was nothing short of being magic. And at some point, I think it was during the middle of the first half, when I looked around and the place was full and I just focused on the football, I realised, you know, the more things change, the more they say stay the same. That's the phrase, isn't it? Something like that. It felt normal. It was like, yeah, man, this is how it always was. You sit here, you've got the smell of the food trucks wafting over, you've got loud and boisterous fans, you've got Warriors chants, you've got, you know, some pretty shabby football, to be honest. But it was a great occasion, and it brought a lot of smiles to a lot of people's faces. And the Warriors, they got a win as well, much needed. So it was just a wonderful day out. Our program today, we have a couple of guests for you. We'll check in with Daryl Bishop a little bit later. He's a regular contributor to our program, of course. He's the chief executive of Ember. And there are no DHBs anymore in New Zealand. Hands up, who knew that? Yeah, they kind of just snuck it in on us last week, July the 1st. Now there is one big entity only called Health NZ. Daryl Bishop with a unique take on this. We'll get to him a little bit later in the program. But first up this morning, we want to talk to a lady called Ruth Shaw. She's led an incredible life, one of adventure, protests, some tragedy, and now ultimately peace. Over the years, she's endured terrible setbacks, and in the depths of depression, she tried to take her own life when she was living in Australia. Now Ruth is 75. She lives in Manapouri in Fiordland, where her pride and joy sit, three tiny bookshops. And her life has been so rich with stories, she's finally been convinced to write a book about herself. And we talk to Ruth Shaw on our program right now. Ruth, it's lovely to have you with us. Thank you so much for your time today. Are you well?
I'm doing really, really well. And thank you so much for having me.
The title of your book, The Bookseller at the End of the World. Did you come up with that title yourself?
No. Jenny, the publisher, came up with it and said, this doesn't have to be the title. But the more I thought about it, the more I liked it, so it stuck.
What does the title tell us about you?
Well, it basically tells you that it's the most, it's very, very remote, but there is a couple of bookshops a little bit further south than me, but they're not as isolated as what Manapouri is. So, it's basically telling you that there is a bookshop in a very remote little area in New Zealand. And in fact, I've got three bookshops, as it tells you in the book. And a lady said to me that I've got more bookshops in Queenstown, which is great.
So you've got three.
Yeah.
You started out with one. And yep. You move to two and then you move to three. And do they all serve a different purpose?
Yes, they do. So the first one is the biggest bookshop, but it's still quite tiny. I wanted to stay within the confines of a space where I didn't have to get a permit. And so that is nearly all non-fiction, but I do have a holiday reading section where the money goes to the blind, and it's more or less books from 45 south and below, so it covers Maori history, New Zealand, sub-Antarctic, Antarctic, a lot on Fiordland. And then the second bookshop is my children's bookshop, which is really tiny, and then the very, very small one, which is really the size of a linen cupboard, is a couple of farmers have said I should call it the Dirty Farmer's Bookshop. Because I built it because of some shepherds that came into the shop and wouldn't come in because they smelt of sheep and silage. And so I thought, well, I really need to have somewhere for them to sit outside where they can have their lunch. But it's actually turned out to be a very, very popular space. And that's kind of the men's section, really. That's hunting, fishing, tractors, trains, farming, dog training, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And where do you source your books from?
Well, I'm closed now, and this is the time I do all my book searching. And I have some really, really fabulous people right throughout New Zealand that whenever they get books they know I want, they contact me. I do a lot of estate work, which is pretty sad in lots of ways. And I go through charity shops. I'm in touch with other book dealers throughout New Zealand. And just recently, I've come across some really beautiful rare books that one of my customers said he wanted to sell. So, and they're extremely rare, but they're just perfect for my bookshop. So I've been to see him a couple of times and come home with masses of books. So I get them wherever I can. And for the children's books, I've got what I call my children's books buyers that searching for really good secondhand books for children.
So you've been in Manapouri now for about 38 years.
Yes.
With your husband, Lance.
Yes.
Which is roughly half of your life. Would it be fair to say that you have led a life of two halves?
Oh, Kent. Yes, but it wasn't easy to settle coming from King's Cross to Manapouri. But it was really good for my inner soul, really, I suppose, and my sanity. But it hasn't been a calm ride. You know, I've still had lots of ups and downs. But the older I get, the better I am. I'm not as chaotic as what I used to be. And I'm a very, very hard person to live with. I know that. And I think I said in my book, I'm not quite sure now, but Lance, when we retired, said, well, I'm going to practice the art of retirement. And he nearly perfected that until I wrote this book. And he has come out of retirement, but I've never really retired. I've just kind of kept on at a high pace, which I can't see myself ever really slowing down. I don't know how old you are, but when you look and you see people that are in their 70s, you think, oh, they're getting old. You're getting old in your body, but you're still really young in your head. And you think you can do a whole lot more than what you really can. So it's a conundrum, really, you know. It's so I just really love life now.
Yeah. But and you've had a fascinating life, you know, which is why we wanted to talk to you today. And the question I asked about whether your life is kind of one of two halves is kind of me leading you into telling us about what you did for the first 30 to 40 years, of which you would probably be able to tell us a million stories.
Yes, and it's not all in the book either. There was a set number of words. When you sign a contract, there's a set number of words. They give you quite a bit of leeway. But some of the chapters I wrote were left out, and also I had to try and track my ex-husbands to make sure that they were happy about me writing them. And I couldn't write how much I wanted regarding my third husband because he asked me not to. And also I felt that I wanted to really, really consider the families of the people I was writing about. And I didn't want to ever hurt anybody. So a lot of the stories have been tempered down. That's why I think it was so important to have the bookshop stories throughout, so that when there was a drama, then there was a little bit of softness about it.
Tell our listeners about your life and a lot of the ups and the downs, because you're in a really good place now, but for a lot of years, would it be fair to say that you struggled?
Absolutely, yes. And mental health back then was not recognised as much as it is now. And I was very lucky when I went into the psychiatric ward that I didn't have the high-powered electric treatment or very, very heavy medication. But I think that I got to the stage where I had to switch off all my emotions, because I knew if I started thinking about things, I would just crash. And I crashed a number of times, but I managed to pick myself up. When I lost Joshua, I think if Joshua had have lived, that was my son that died. If Joshua had have lived, I think I would have been able to pull myself together a lot earlier. But because he didn't, As I said in my book, I wasn't scared of dying. I really wasn't scared of dying.
Because you had your setbacks. So Joshua lived for only 13 hours.
Yes.
Before that, you were raped at the age of 17.
Yes.
And because of the way that things were back then, you were forced to give up your son for adoption.
Yeah, like hundreds, thousands of young women and at that time. Nobody asked you how you became pregnant. They just all kind of accept or thought that, oh, yes, you're out playing the field, bit of a slut. But in fact, when I was in the ward having my baby, and it was a ward for single mums, so we're all there waiting to have our babies, it was interesting that, and I didn't put this in the book either, because a lot of those women will now be, they might remember me, and I remember some of them. But there was about maybe 6 beds in the ward, and there was only 2 of them that said, yes, I'd slept around. And the other 4, it was through a fairly traumatic situation that they ended up getting pregnant. But nobody ever asked you that. They just, you were painted straight away. And so that's why you were sent away, because communities didn't accept you, didn't want to know about you, really. Yeah.
Do you have anyone to lean on for support?
Yeah, my mother was absolutely brilliant. My father was traumatised by it. Mm. It wasn't until I was nursing my mum, who was dying of cancer, that I found out why it never went to the police. And I think that played on my father for a long time. When you're in a small community, you have to continue living in that community. So my mother was absolutely incredible. And when I went up to Wellington, my auntie and uncle that where I lived while I was pregnant were fantastic. And the doctor that she took me to was absolutely amazing. And he was the first one to say to me, Ruth, I need to know how you're feeling about this pregnancy. And have you ever really felt that you've wanted this baby? And how come you're pregnant? And I couldn't write about that in the book. There was lots of things I wanted to say in the book, but they were too harsh. Mm. I didn't want people to read my book and then think, oh, my God, you know, here she goes again, another bloody drama in her life. And I wanted to make sure there was a positivity about it so that people would see that there's an inner strength in us that we can get through it. What's interesting, Kent, is that I've had masses and masses of letters and cards and emails and telephone calls, because I'm very easily found in Manapouri. And I had one letter from an 82-year-old woman who wrote her story, and it was the first time she'd ever admitted that she had been sexually abused as a child. And she said after reading my book, she felt she could tell me her story. And it's just absolutely amazing when it shows you the power of words and how careful you have to be when you write. And I wrote back to this woman and told her how incredibly brave she was, that she'd carried that burden all of her life. She's been married, she's got children and grandchildren, and none of them knew. So there's hundreds of people, thousands of people like that, men and women, because I've had correspondence from men as well.
Taken from us, we're talking with Ruth Shaw on the program, author of The Bookseller at the End of the World. She's got an amazing life story to tell us. And Ruth, you've had the opportunity to reunite with your son, the one that you had to give up for adoption, And yes. I understand you're a grandmother. How's that been?
It's pretty amazing, really. I prepared myself for anything, but I was more worried that when I found my son, he wouldn't accept me because I was still a mess. And when we saw each other, we just knew that no matter what our history was, that we were going to be pretty good mates. And we are. We have a lot of laughs. And then the most amazing thing was that then I had Joshua come into my life. I mean, Isaac come into my life. And Isaac now lives in Sweden. And we keep in very, very close contact. And he is a very, very gentle soul. And it's just proof that that something good can come out of anything, really. So I'm very, very, very lucky, Kent.
How old's Isaac?
He is about 35. And he's gorgeous.
I bet.
We always say that about our children, don't we, and our grandchildren.
Is he? He's probably due a trip to New Zealand, is he?
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
He is. And he's going to come down. He lived with us. He lived with us for about 2 years. And that was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. When you were younger, because you deserted the Navy, so did you have a rebellious streak or did you not
always
like authority? Right, okay, so you is that why you're difficult to live with?
Yeah, I think so.
You got that rebellious streak?
I think I might have got it from my father.
Okay.
Even as a very, very young child, I was quite rebellious. And my grandmother that taught me how to gamble and play cards saw that in me. Whereas my sister was always well-behaved, always well-presented. She had beautiful long blonde hair, totally different than me. And I've always been dark. And I've always been in trouble. Not that I look for trouble, it's just that, as my father told me, he said, you're always pushing the boundaries. I just wish you would stop pushing boundaries. So, and I always, in Naseby, there weren't very many children because there was only 180 people. And so most of my playmates as a young person were guys. And I don't know, I just saw life as a very exciting wonderland, really. And I wanted to experience, building fires and smoking. And, yeah, there was never really, I never thought any harm would come of it. So I still push boundaries. I still do. I believe that we can. I say to a lot of women, they say, oh, but you've done so much. But am I prattling on?
No. No, keep talking.
They say, all I've done is got married and had children. And I think one of the most precious and important things in life is a mother and father successfully bringing up children and how much they have to sacrifice to do that. I look at young couples that are holding down jobs, bringing up a family, making sure their children are all okay, and that to me is a massive challenge. I've never had that challenge, but I just think the strength of character of those parents, and it's so important. And they say, but we've led a boring life. No, they haven't. They haven't. They've led a worthwhile life. And they've given a lot to society and communities. It's just that we don't. When I was doing geriatric nursing, I used to say to the old people, you know, what did you do as a young person? Because you saw an old person in bed that was wetting the bed or couldn't go to the toilet, or you're always cleaning them. But they had a life. And I wrote a little bit about that. But I remember one woman that I nursed, and her name was Zoe, and she had really, really, really big pendulous breasts, and I used to have to actually lift them up to wash and dry underneath them and then put a cream on them. And I said to her, you know, what was your life like when you were young, when you were in your 20s? And she blew me away because she said, I was a spy. It just blew me away. Here was this old woman that nobody visited, and she had this amazing story to tell. And she always came across as this soft, lovely kind of, I bet you were a good grandmother, you know, a lovely grandmother, but you never thought about her as a 20-year-old. And she said, now this was quite a long time ago, so I would have only been about 30, maybe 32 or something. And she said, Ruthie, I've had a fucking ride. You know, and here's this woman that had never sworn.
Yes.
And then we became quite close. And so I look at elderly people and I don't see a wizened up old person in a chair or somebody dribbling ice. Mm. I try and see past that and think, you know, what the hell's gone on in your life?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that was a great point that Viktor Frankl made in his very good book, Man's Search for Meaning. He said the same thing. If you see an elderly person, don't pity them. They may have led an amazing life.
What's the name of that book?
Man's Search for Meaning.
Wow.
Yeah, Viktor Frankl, he was a prisoner of war survivor. The odds of him living were very, very small. He came out the back end, went into something called logotherapy, which was basically helping people find their meaning of life. It's a really short book, and it's a wonderful read and very sobering, but that was one of his key points, was when you see older people, and they might be dribbling, or they might have a walking stick, or you think, oh, poor old bugger, geez, man, I bet he's struggling. Don't pity old people, because they might have the most amazing, rich life that they could share with you.
Absolutely.
Isn't that cool?
It is. When was that book published?
Oh, geez.
Is it a really old book?
Yeah, it's an older book, yeah.
Oh, I'll have to try and get a copy.
I was just thinking though about you pushing boundaries. If we don't push boundaries, our boundaries don't get bigger, do they?
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Like our comfort zone, that our comfort zones never increase if we don't push them.
Exactly.
So society, we need people like you, Ruth.
Well,
to question and to antagonise.
You sound like you push boundaries too.
Oh, I've probably been guilty of that in my time. My parents would probably say that. But as we wrap up our chat today, and it's been so lovely to talk to you. You opened the library in Manapouri in 2016. You've now got the three little bookshops, and I know clearly that you are just really immersed in this lifestyle that you have. What is it about it? What is it about your lifestyle that just keeps you upbeat and feeling optimistic about life?
It's hard to think optimistic about life at the moment with what's happening over in Ukraine and
sure.
You know, everything going on. But as I say, they say, oh, what can we do? And I say, well, just do what you think you can and try and spread happiness and contentment. And all that sounds airy-fairy, but what happens in the bookshop is that I meet the most wonderful people. We have incredible conversations. I don't care if I need to sell a book. I don't need to sell a book.
Right.
I'm retired. I don't need lots and lots of money, but I'm surrounded by books that I love, and I can't live without books. And I've got an amazing husband that puts up with me and helps me. And I meet all these wonderful people in a tiny little town that just energizes me every day. And it's, I don't know, I just think that life can go on until all of a sudden one day you drop dead. And, yeah.
Mm. And I'll bet you people come from miles around, do they? From overseas, from everywhere, to your little bookshops.
Yes, they do. And that's what's so exciting.
Neat.
Even over COVID, people were coming down from Auckland, and that was before I even wrote my book. They had heard via the grapevine, because I don't have a website. The bookshop's too small for a website. And people just come and say, oh, I've heard about your bookshop, and that's how I meet all these lovely people. I think people that love books have just a slightly different focus on life. And I know when somebody really loves books, they'll come into the bookshop, they'll look for the oldest book, they'll open it and they'll smell it. And that's one thing you have to be careful of when you buy books, is that they don't smell of smoke. If they've been in a smoky room, they don't smell damp, they don't smell mouldy. Mm. And so they smell the book, and quite often they'll say, oh, God, that's so good.
Yeah. Books are important. You know, we can't really go without them, I believe.
I believe that too.
With the advent of modern-day technology, we know this now, that fewer and fewer people are reading. And we also know that, you know, retaining information and learning, we're much better at it when we're actually reading printed material as opposed to stuff that's online. So we need books to be smart, I guess, is what I'm thinking. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. How many books have you got in your house?
Oh, geez. Not as many as you. My problem is hoarding them. Like my partner says, you have to throw them out. You don't read them anymore. But I don't also want to have, you know, just books and books and books and books that I'll never look at and touch again. But I find it difficult to throw them out.
Absolutely.
They need to go to worthy people, don't they? You need to share them.
You do. But then you've got books that you would never part with.
That's right.
And it's interesting that, you know, I've got books everywhere. And how often I think, oh, I've got a book that's about that, or I've read about that in a book, and I'll go and find that book. And I might not have taken it out of the shelf for 5 or 6 years, but something clicks about that book and you're so happy that you've got it.
Yeah.
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 So, but I'm very lucky because I've got someone to leave all my books to, whereas there's a lot of people that come in the bookshop and they say they've got no one to leave their books to. And that's really sad. But I've got someone to leave mine to. Yeah.
All right. Hey, look, Ruth, it's been lovely to have you on the program. Thank you so much. We'll get people to pick up a copy of your book. And please keep pushing those boundaries, eh?
Hope you enjoyed our chat there with Ruth Shaw. By the way, her book is called The Bookseller at the End of the World. That's a lady that just has been in love with books for years and years and years and years and years. And, you know, it's great to see, too, that people are still passionate about books, because I was reading something recently, actually, to say that there have now been, I think, more than 50 peer-reviewed scientific studies to show that we actually have better memories, we retain more information when we actually read something that's in hard copy, you know, like a rattle-rattle, a piece of paper or a magazine or a newspaper or a book. And it's because it's just plain black and white print, we actually absorb that information in our screens and our phones. Our brains are flashing, we're enticed by the colours and the noise, and we're bouncing all over the screen and we don't take as much information in. So for someone who's been a lifelong reader and someone who is still passionate about reading books like me, that's a nice reinforcement that we're on the right track when we pick up a book and enjoy it. Ruth, what a fantastic lady and a really great, I guess, honour and privilege to have her on our program today. So check out that the name of that book again for you, The Bookseller at the End of the World. Allen and Unwin Publishers, at recommended retailer of about $37. That'll be money well spent. We're looking forward to maybe having a chat with her at some point further on down the track. We'll see how we go. Take it from us. Still to come on our program today is Daryl Bishop. Time, though, for a little piece of music. This is Ben Harper on Take It From Us, Diamonds on the Inside.
I knew a girl, her name was Truth. She was a horrible liar. She couldn't spend one day alone, but she couldn't be satisfied. When you have everything, you have everything to lose. She made herself a bed of nails, and she's planning on putting it to use. But she had diamonds on inside. Diamonds on inside. She had diamonds on inside. Diamonds. A candle throws its light into the darkness. In a nasty world, so shines a good deed. Make sure the fortune that you see is the fortune that you need. So tell me why first ask is the last to give every time. What you say
it from us, Ben Harper, Diamonds on the Inside. Hugely popular in New Zealand, Ben Harper, I think more so than most other countries in the world. That's why he's always here performing. So there you go, eh? Little fun fact. Still to come, Karen is going to tell us about her reading Ruth's book, and we've got our Sheldon shout-out as well. Joining us now, though, is Daryl Bishop, who you're very familiar with his voice. He's a regular contributor to our program. He is the chief executive of Ember, and he's always passionate and enthusiastic when he talks about what's going on in our community. Daryl, nice to have you back on the program. It's been a little while. How are you?
I'm good, Kent. I'm good. It feels like this is the final winter of the COVID era, and we're all desperately hoping for spring. So, by my count, I think we're 6-7 weeks away from spring. So it's coming.
Yeah.
It's coming.
Yeah, and we start doing these little mental gymnastics in our head, don't we? We're past the shortest day. We're now into July. Yeah, we're closer to daylight savings than when we came out. We start to do all of these things. But let's be honest, we've just got a little bit of a slog ahead for a few weeks with this mucky winter weather.
I'm trying to be positive, Kent. You know me, just positive. You know, Matariki. Then it's my birthday in August, and then
yeah,
it's September, and you know, it's spring once we get to September, isn't it?
Yeah. Matariki was brilliant a week or so ago, and my partner and I were both thinking, man, can you imagine how inspired that was? Our first crack at it.
Yeah.
For a lot of us, we weren't sure how it would go, and you know, what would be required and sort of what is expected and what it all means. But I think with that educational process that we've all been through, come even next year, which will only be the second time we get to commemorate and celebrate, it will seem like such an awesome occasion.
Yeah, I thought it was really, really nice. I wondered how it was going to land, but it was really nice that the Te Ao Māori aspects of reflection and thinking about the people that were with us and the people that had gone in the last year was a really beautiful thing to do. It kind of reminds me of the New Year's celebration. I come from an Irish sort of family, and the traditions in that culture when I was younger, you know, about some of the things where a man would come and knock at your door on New Year's Eve, and you'd see all the bad stuff out from the year before and welcome all the new stuff in. It kind of felt a bit like that. So it was really, really, I thought it was really good. I really enjoyed it. And it was nice to have a Friday off.
As opposed to the Mondays that we're used to.
Yeah, I quite liked having a Friday off. It felt really nice.
One thing that might have slipped by, actually, unnoticed for a lot of our community last week, July the 1st, the DHBs have been abolished. So where are we at, and what do you think?
Well, it's often historic moments happen and you realise they're historic later, and I think that's kind of happening here. I mean, I've been in New Zealand for 23 years, and I've only worked in the DHB system, so it's all I've really known in New Zealand. The structure and the delivery and the funding processes for the DHBs are how we've done health in New Zealand for a generation, love it or hate it, good bits and bad bits, and it's just gone. It's not there anymore, and I don't think everybody realises, Kent. I think certainly spend my life within health and everybody realizes, and we're talking about it all the time, but certainly talking to my wife and to my family and to friends and over dinner last week with some friends, and people haven't got any idea, you know, that that's happened and what it could mean for them, good and bad, because obviously there will be good bits and bad bits. You know, the 20 district health boards are gone. All their deficits have been wiped off, which I thought was quite an interesting thing, having been myself in so many meetings over recent years where the DHB's deficits were such a part of the conversation. The fact that the government can just wipe them just like that is great. People don't realise that the new agency, for example, Health New Zealand, because it's the combined workforces of all the DHBs, now employs 82,000 health employees. So 82,000 health staff work directly for Health New Zealand. It makes it one of the largest employers around. It's got a $24 billion budget, which is up 43% in the last 5 years. It's a big beast, and it's largely going to be steered from Wellington, although there will be locality funding and locality delivery in the regions around the country. A lot of the plan and a lot of the sort of the captain of the ship will be in Wellington, which is different to the DHBs, where there were 20 ships, you know, a flotilla of DHBs replaced by one great big steamboat instead.
Yeah, and you're so right. when something of this magnitude comes along, it's not for months, if not years down the track, that we realise the consequence of the change. And there is that classic law of unintended consequence as well, for good or for bad. If you can crystal ball gaze, do you have a kind of a feel as to how this might play out, the good, the bad, the indifferent?
Yeah, I mean, generally, you know, I was on record. I wrote an article for the New Zealand Doctor saying that I support it. But as on the whole, the principles of it, I think are right. I think that, and this is my opinion, this is not the opinion of my organisation, or, you know, other views are available and all that. But I think we've lacked a plan for health nationally. There've been the benefits of driving things regionally were that you've got that regional flavour. So a plan for Dunedin was written by people in Dunedin, and that was really good. But I think what we lacked as a result was sort of joined up thinking and planning for the whole country. And I think that will lead to better use of resources, in my view, and better structures and better governance. So that's the positive thing. I think so what you should end up... So thinking of it from a patient or a client or Tangata Whaiora point of view, you should get the similar service now if you're in Ekatahuna, if you're in Northland, if you're in Bay of Plenty, if you're in Wellington, Christchurch, Dunedin, Auckland. You should get a similar service because the planning can be done as a whole country. Probably on the downside, what you then lose is you lose some of that ability to really drive based on local needs. So they're going to have to be really careful to make sure they still make the communication both ways. It's all right to have a plan written in Wellington, but the risk of that is you lose, you know, the sense of planning locally from the local community. So they're going to have to make sure that the locality structures allow for that. Otherwise, you know, Wellington's not New Zealand. We all know that. People in Wellington don't always understand what's going on around the country. So we've just got to make sure. But that's the job of also of people like me and people in my sort of position to make sure that we advocate for the communities we work in. So there'll be that bit. I think, I'm trying to think of a nice way of saying this, Kent, but I think there'll be a little bit of disruption for a while. Hopefully, I mean, I heard Chris Hipkin, who's somebody said, oh no, it was Pete Watson, who's got a senior role in Health New Zealand, saying last night he thought it might be 10 years. I hope it's not 10 years, but I think we can probably forecast, you know, for the next year, I think things will be quite disrupted and people will be a bit confused within planning and delivery structures as to what's going on, which is a disadvantage. But the advantage of that, from my perspective, is I think you see historically around the world that often innovators thrive in chaos. So I think we'll see opportunity for people with new ideas, opportunity for people who can propose better ways of doing things to come to the fore and actually have their ideas heard and the planning that's happening in Wellington take on new ideas, which one of the problems in recent years is the layers of bureaucracy that we've had in the system through the DHBs, through to the Ministry of Health, has meant that it's been really hard to innovate. It's been really hard to have new ideas. So hopefully we see some of that in the next year. We can get some of our fresh, exciting innovators and you know, young people coming through who've got new ideas. Some of their ideas can become part of the plan, hopefully.
And at the end of this month, there's the Transforming Mental Health Conference in Auckland. And that is, you know, one of the key thrusts of the conference is to be able to throw forward new ideas and listen to some out-of-the-box thinking. That'll be something you're looking forward to.
I am. What great timing. Because, you know, that's an important conference anyway because of it's the one event in New Zealand where we talk directly and specifically about transformation. You know, we talk about not just how we can improve services, but how we could do them completely different. So that's always been the theme of that event. I guess it has extra importance because it'll be the first time we'll have a gathering of mental health leaders following the reforms. And there'll be people represented from Health New Zealand, but also from the sector and from people who use services. We're also trying to support some entrepreneurs and innovators to be there who wouldn't normally come to a mental health event like that because they're too busy doing their entrepreneuring and their innovating. So we're supporting some of those people to be there too. So I think it's a good opportunity in the current climate to think about how we can get innovation in this time of change and disruption because, yeah, That's what we want to see. We want to see it flourish. And it's 2 days. It's quite a lot of really good speakers, but also lots of opportunity for those really important conversations over coffee and over lunch and that sort of stuff. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It'll be good. And it's good that it's in Auckland, because that's normally in Wellington, that event. So having it in Auckland, I think, brings it a different audience.
Mm. And do you get the sense, might be too early to know, but do you get the sense that the people out there who are wanting to innovate and wanting to contribute and wanting to maybe change things up a little bit would be encouraged by the changes that we've seen out of Wellington? Do you think they might feel emboldened to perhaps really stamp their mark?
I think, as always, it's just a mixed bag, Ken. I think yes. I think that people feel that there is an admission in this health reform that continuing to do the way things the way we've been doing them previously isn't going to work. You know, the whole, you know, doing the same thing repeatedly, expecting different results, just doesn't fly. So I think the intent of the government, I would applaud and say that they're intending for this to be a platform to do different things. So innovators who I speak to are, and there are innovators in the system already, and then there are innovators outside the system. I would say they are a bit emboldened by that. However, there is always in New Zealand a sense of healthy cynicism about intent leading to actual change. And I think anybody who's over, anybody who's as old as me and you, Kent, has seen change before not lead to, you know, real change in all areas of life, whether it be health, education, sport. You know,
yeah.
Everybody talks, it says it's going to be different, but sometimes it isn't. So, but I always take that responsibility personally, because, you know, there's a famous adage that you're not in a traffic jam, you are a traffic jam. And if you're saying the sector you're working isn't changing and you're a leader in that sector, then that's your responsibility. So that's up to me and other people in the sector. It's not just up to government to drive change. Mm. And we will work really hard to seize this opportunity to try and do things better, differently, trial some new things. And that's not, I'm not just talking about Ember, I'm just talking about a whole range of people who I think are trying to do that anyway.
Yeah, and Karen and I from Take It From Us will be there for the mental health conference at the end of the month. So we will get I think I'm contributing. Yeah, you've drafted me in to contribute. So I'm looking forward to that, and just looking forward to meeting a few people and just getting a sense of how we're all going, and looking forward to reporting back for our audience and maybe bringing forward some new people to speak to. So that'll be good. And Daryl, just a quick comment too on the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission's new pathways document.
Yeah, it's Athena, I think many things about it. I think first and foremost, I think it's a good document, and it's kind of a document which gives you a sense of what a pathway through mental health and addiction services should look like. And I would recommend that people read it. But I think the thing that I like about it the most is the way it's been written, because this is a document that's taken a year to write, because they did consultation and co-design of the pathway document properly. So they asked an awful lot of people to input into it. They took people on their journey through iterations of the document. So the pathways document that's come out, I think, really reflects that really good process. And we're saying this to people all the time, whether they be policy makers, policy writers, organizations, that if you want to do something meaningful, take your time, talk to the people involved, ask their view, be open to changing your opinion based on what people tell you, and then you tend to land in the right place. So I was really excited reading that document this morning with my breakfast and my coffee, because I'd been peripherally involved in some of the consultation, that it had landed where it had landed, because it did reflect a good process. So I think that's all you can do when you write these, because no document ever changed anything really. But I think these guidance, these pathways documents, these frameworks that are being produced are much more valuable if they reflect a real process. And I think this one does. I really do recommend, and we can chuck the link out on the show when you advertise it next week. I recommend people go and have a look at it, because it's a good thing. It's a good thing. And it's really the first contribution the new Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission have made in terms of a concrete, because they were reformed about a year ago, sometime during the fog of COVID, Kent, they were formed. reconstituted, and this is a thing that they've done that I think will add good value to how we plan and deliver and think about mental health and addiction services.
Nothing but good vibes out of you today, and lots to be optimistic and perhaps even things to be a little bit thankful for at the moment, eh?
Yeah, we couldn't do what we do without being positive. We have to be thinking about what we can achieve rather than focusing on the negative. And as I said before, it's up to all of us to drive change. You don't just sit back and wait for governments to do for you. You get involved and you get your hands dirty and you do the change with them, because that's what we need to do.
Thanks to Daryl Bishop, who was a regular contributor to our program here on Take It From Us. That's almost our show for another week. Karen is with me, of course, Karen Murphy, who does a great job producing our program. And Karen, I know you really enjoyed our conversation with Ruth a little bit earlier, and you've got a copy of her book, and you're telling me it's great.
Oh, yes. I started reading it a few nights ago, and I've really been enjoying it. She's a great writer, so you can tell that she's a big reader, obviously, all her life. But some just great storytelling of her adventures, of her life. Very moving, it's a great story, so I thoroughly would recommend it.
I'm going to grab it once you're finished with it. She was terrific to talk to. And what a life, eh? 75 years of age, she's packed so much in. And you think of all of the wild adventure and tragedy of the earlier part to now just kind of tranquil, peaceful. Well, she probably wouldn't say peaceful, but a more relaxed, slow vibe in a place like Manapouri.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful location. And I love, in the book, she talks about the people that come to the bookshop and how she recommends books and sort of sees them and sees what they need and recommends the right book. I love that.
Thanks, Karen. Who's our Sheldon shout-out this week?
Well, it's for the 350 volunteers in the Burwood Red Zone area of Christchurch who went out this weekend and planted 5,000 native trees in that dead zone there in 2.5 hours. So I think that's sort of great community coming together and working together to sort of beautify an area that's sort of been lost, and sort of people have said that it made them feel good. It sort of helped heal them spiritually and mentally, and brought them out together with their community. So
that's out in nature contributing to our community, it does make us feel good. So well done to those people. And what a pace they set, eh? That's a terrific work rate. Good for them. Lovely little story to end our program this week. Thanks to Karen, who's put the show together. Thanks again to Daryl Bishop, and in particular to Ruth Shaw as well. Take it from us. Take care of yourselves and each other. We'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us.